Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you, and she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Welcome to Nature Best Last and the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This August 25th, 2015 edition, episode 52 of Nature Best Last comes to you live from Tucson, Arizona. Our thanks to Afrozin for his theme song contribution, and you can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. This week we have a climate change update from Guy. We have a Doomer of the Week, which we hadn't had in a while. And we begin with our guest interview. John Zerzan has been active in the anarchist circles for some time and has done his weekly anarchy radio broadcast for the past 15 years. His books include Elements of Refusal, Future Primitive, Running on Emptiness, Against Civilization, Twilight of the Machines, and Future Primitive Revisited. This fall, his Why Hope will appear. He's spoken widely since 2001 from an anarcho-primitivist, green anarchy, civilization critique perspective. Welcome to Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network, John.
Thanks. Good afternoon.
I think some of our listeners are aware of anarcho-primitivism, and I was wondering if you could kind of unpack that phrase for us a little for those who do not. Maybe start with anarchism and then move to primitivism.
Well, that's a tall order, but I think in terms of Nature Bats Last, the point is, what is driving the tremendous crisis, the eco-catastrophe that's already upon us, as you guys well know. And it comes down to civilization critique. It comes down to why every civilization dies, why it implodes, and it gets back to the very nature of civilization, which is domestication. That's what gives birth to civilizations, and that is the ethos of control and domination of nature. And it plays itself out, and that's what happens. I mean, it's just, it repeats itself. And this one, this now global unitary civilization, is doing the same thing. But strangely enough, I think what we're contending with is, quite frankly, in terms of an anarchist point of view such as this one, is the unwillingness of access to ideas that are radical. I mean, for example, have you ever had an anarchist on your show before?
Not one that would admit it.
Well, yeah, kidding. And yet you call it the most radical radio show.
I mean,
you're a liberal radio show. I mean, you've got to talk about things in depth or else we're wasting our time. Of course, the other option is just throw up our hands. Well, we're done for. We're screwed. We can't do anything. Mm-hmm. So rather than take a radical analysis and a course of action based on that, it's, you know, for some, the alternative is, oh, too late, can't do nothing, surrender and bye-bye, you know, that, right. Which I don't accept at all.
Right. So where you go, this is Guy, can you go into a little detail? Is there, in your work, there's a link between anarchism and primitivism. Can you talk about some other kinds of anarchism, other kinds of primitivism?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a big split between the red anarchists, the old line 19th century classical leftist anarchists, and I think what is in the ascendant, especially among the youth, is the green kind, the anti-civilization, the realization that you can have self-managed factories, as the old anarchists want, but what if the existence of factories is exactly the problem? I mean, global warming is a function of how many factories there are. You know, full stop, right? Everybody right. knows that. It started with the Industrial Revolution, and now we've got a globalized industrial machine upon which all technology rests. That's also totally obvious. But almost nobody in the mainstream, including progressives, want to talk about that. They don't want to see the consequences of that, which are, I think, again, very obvious. So that's the big split. I mean, there are the old line leftist anarchists who rather loathe us, like, say, Noam Chomsky. I mean, he has a fit when people mention the Critique of Civilization, or he always has. I don't know lately if he's changed at all. I haven't heard if he has, I haven't heard about it. So there's a very big chasm there. If you want this whole world, if you want mass society, industrialized everything, the end of the biosphere, well, let's keep going on. You worship capital, you worship progress of the capital P, the whole shebang, modernity is great. Well, to us, that's just suicide. That's just crazy. But they have exactly the opposite point of view. And their main line is, if I think I have this right, look, there are 7 billion people. You can't talk about a primitivist future with 7 billion people. But our reply, or at least what I would say, is why are there 7 billion people? What drives this? What has made that another crazy part of reality, that there are that many people and more every minute? You know, that's not a natural occurrence. It didn't happen before domestication. And again, the next spike, of course, was industrialization, you know, 200 plus years ago, which puts us into the global warming stage, the final stage, unless we don't pull the plug on all of it.
So do you think, John, that the lack of willingness to look at the consequences of the industrial civilized culture is because that people, literally, it's part of their identity?
Well, yeah, so far. But again, if nobody is allowed to talk about it, we don't know. I mean, we don't know how. Everybody says, well, not everybody, but, oh, people are so wedded to everything, it can't change because people want to have all the conveniences. And I might include myself. I mean, you know, we don't know for sure, but, you know, that's kind of a self-fulfilling thing. If there isn't any dialogue at all, for one thing, then how do you know? Or another way to put this, a friend of mine said quite some time ago, you'll never change everything by promising people less. And he meant that we primitivist types are promising people less. You know, you don't get to turn your wrist a fraction and the hot water pours out.
Yeah.
You may not have it like that. It may be different than that, right? So
yeah, less in terms of what they know as to being less, I guess.
Well, exactly.
I mean, you clearly offer more,
I think,
but it's not what they think. The only
thing that will change this is the realization that more is actually less. I mean,
right.
We get to a place where you're not abandoning this wonderful life for some horrible primitivist life. You're mm-hmm. abandoning an insane life. Look at the shootings every day now. I mean, you can't catalog all the pathologies, not only the physical environment, but the social environment, the personal, the spiritual environment, all that stuff. It's incredibly insane. And I think it may be, I don't know, but it may be that fairly soon people will say, look, this is just nuts, and our kids will have an even more whacked out pseudo-life than we do. They'll all be on drugs, and there'll be shootings every day at schools or the malls or family slaughters, you know, the thing that's happening every day now. You know, the stuff that nobody wants to talk about, but here it is, you know.
Right. So can you point to some examples where anarcho-primitivism is working today? Where
no, there aren't any. It's not possible to work today. I mean, if we could do that, then everybody would do that, right? I mean, it's the force field of civilization is so powerful that, yeah, I know people on the land. I know people that are doing practical stuff, but I don't think any of them delude themselves that is stopping the cancer of civilization.
No,
They're just learning
that's not really
skills.
what I mean. Are there tribal societies somewhere
No,
where?
no. How can there be? This is a totalized world. I mean, it's, you know, that's a routine question, but I think the when you look at the answer, then you real it's just another way of saying how impossible this thing is. You know, if it were that easy, you know, we'd just be doing it right now. But, you know, where do you start? I mean, you have a lot of capital for land. Well, we don't have a lot of capital for land. I don't know who does, and so forth. I mean, you know, plus you can't really get away from the toxicity. You can't get away from the globalized mass culture. No matter where it is, everybody's on their cell phones and everything. I mean, you know, you can't just say, well, let's go do that. You've got these great ideas. Why don't you put them into practice? Well, the answer again is that tells you how powerful the whole deal is that we're up against.
Absolutely. So, I mean, even you're including in this answer even tribes that have been quote unquote uncontacted.
Oh no, I don't mean. I'm not speaking for any indigenous groups. There are people who are holding out, and there are Native Americans right now who are, you know, on the front lines against the pipelines
Okay.
and more than anyone,
Right.
and so forth. There are people. I know people in southern Arizona that are trying to hang on to their ancestral traditions. You know, that's the thing that I think the anarchist thing needs most of all, is to connect with that, to be accomplices for them and allies for them and learning from them, that strand that goes back to a life that wasn't massified and ridiculous like the one we have now.
Right. So what do you think's holding back, I guess, if that's the correct way of putting it, the anarchist community from doing that, from following or from
Well, that's
taking
a good question. There are some anarchists who are doing that. In Arizona, up in BC, you know, there are scattered deals, but and I think it's growing. I think I mentioned the I think it's the ascendancy in the anarchist milieu is strongly anti-civilization. But you know, that's the challenge. I mean, how do you convert that into actual practice?
Right.
Even if we were allies to some indigenous people, which would be wonderful and would be a fabulous lifeline, I think, for us, that still doesn't undo the world we have that we're trying to endure and overcome. I mean, that's part of it, but it's not an instant answer either.
It seems that most people, when they hear anarchist or anarchy, they have clearly this chaotic sort of picture in their head of people running around and there's chaos and there's looting. And that seem anytime I bring up, you know, anarchy or that I'm going to have an anarchist on or I have anarchist leanings, that's kind of the picture that comes into their head. If you were going to talk to somebody that basically had that, which is most people, had that vision in their head, where would you start them, as far as maybe?
Well, I wouldn't start by debunking that, quite frankly, in the first place. It's resistance that's going to change this. And if there's no resistance, ain't nothing going to change. And all the progressives like Chris Hedges can viciously attack, say, Black Bloc anarchists in the streets as a cancer on Occupy, as he somewhat famously said, what, 3 years ago or something, when Occupy was still here, as weak as that was. I'm in favor of riots and arsons. You've got to go through that. Otherwise, you're just kidding yourself.
Right. But if that's all they know, what else is there? Where else would you start them to know more?
I'm sorry?
But if that is all they know is the riot part, where would you suggest they
Well,
start to
I would
learn
make
more?
the
I mean,
case for
it's
riots.
actually not one-dimensional, so
I'm
where would you
not
start?
saying, you know, I remember Warren Churchill once said, what's effective? We don't know. We haven't been effective yet, but he said, if a peace vigil holding candles is effective, I'm 100% for that.
Right.
But it's not effective, is it? You know,
No.
and we don't have much on offer to show. I mean, 15 years ago, there was the anti-democracy WTO riots in Seattle, which right. to some degree put our ideas out more than they would have been, because there were primitivist anarchists there, I think. Or even the Unabomber stuff in the mid-90s. And now right. there are groups operating in Mexico that are Unabomber groups that are doing violent stuff. You know, I don't think arson is violent if nobody's hurt. You know, that's the way I look at it. You can't violate a building. You know, that's not the same. But I think there's going to be some, I think clearly to me anyway, it's going to take people actually doing something. Otherwise, it's just hot air. And right. people have said to me, well, good ideas make their way no matter what happens. I hope that's true, but I don't see evidence of that. Yeah. You know, there's got to be something behind it. And that'll happen or it won't happen.
So you're trying to push this along, at least in terms of the message, and you were way ahead of most people on these topics, which is why we're having this conversation. Do you have a sense that people are catching up to your ideas? Do you see a movement building in the direction you've been dragging people for a while?
Well, I wouldn't take that much credit. I mean, I think to a lot of us, and I'm not endorsing, okay, first of all, I'm not endorsing sending bombs in the mail, okay? But the Unabomber phenomenon, it was kind of interesting. I mean, I remember that really well. Especially 95, 96, and how many more people than I had dreamed of were rather sympathetic to that message. Right. I think they were not sympathetic to, you know, blowing people up, and that's another topic. But I was kind of amazed at how many people, both here and elsewhere, made comments that showed they already knew that. They already knew how toxic the technological society is. I was amazed by that, because if it's not really talked about, how do people know that? Well, they know about it from their experience. So anyway, I'm just guessing here, but I think there is kind of a big reservoir of antipathy to all this stuff. And it's very inchoate, because, again, you don't get much chance for the public dialogue on this stuff. I'm never invited to Charlie Rose or nobody else is either for discussions that toss aside the nonsense that passes for politics, all the trivial side issues that people can't seem to get enough of 24 hours a day thanks to corporate media. But, you know, I think it's there. I think people are getting sick of it, even though I see people, you know, zombie-like, glued to their device, walking along. They'll walk right into you because they can't take their faces off the screen. That's not a positive thing. That's not a hopeful thing. But I just sort of guessing, but I think that'll wear off. That's empty. People are more and more isolated than they ever were. We're not connected by the technology. Sorry. But we're just not. Every study shows that. People feel more cut off and adrift and isolated. That's why we're having these shootings all the time, because there's no community. Mass civilization does away with that. So the whole thing is becoming just putrid and intolerable. I really think it is. No matter how many billions they spend, these politicians spend spreading crap about nonsense stuff. It's the real stuff is here, and it ain't pretty.
Your commentary makes you sound a lot like Edward Abbey, especially when you say you're not promoting putting bombs into mailboxes and that sort of thing. How did you arrive at this perspective? Who or what were some of the major influences for you along the way? I mean, you weren't born rebelling.
Well, you know, I think basically for me, including my optimism, by the way, is kind of a function of the 60s. I came of age in the 60s. And I was in the Bay Area in California. I was at the perfect place at the perfect time to get an education and to see people rising up. And, of course, the movement of the 60s was a global thing as long as it lasted and as far as it did. But we weren't talking about technology. You know, a lot of people thought it was the glorious next step of liberation. You know, the Kesey, people like that, the Whole Earth guy, Stuart Brand. Anyway, as I was working in my research, as my writing, I was first writing about unionism, original unions in England, in the textile industry, you know, the first factories. And right. and then it became, then it, I started noticing, and I wasn't the only one, to notice that the technology itself has a carceral aspect, as to put it in Foucault's term, that it is disciplinary. And I began to notice, what if all technology has that capacity? And it really seemed to me, it's more and more division of labor and specialization, the more disciplinary it is. And it's not neutral. It's just not neutral. And no matter how many times you hear that said, it the dominant values inhere in the technology. And that was the work I was doing in the 70s and 80s. Slowly. I mean, one thing leads to another. I didn't have any great brainstorm one day, but, you know, it just seemed to be, that was the thread of it. And people like Freddie Perlman was also at the same time doing amazing work, the late Freddie Perlman. Anyway, just, you know, I decided to really spend my life trying to pursue these questions, and slowly, to me, it emerged that it goes all the way back down to domestication, which is the cornerstone of civilizations. And there you have it. I mean, to me, that's a liberatory sort of light bulb that goes on. It's not, it could be so daunting, but I don't feel that way. I just feel like, well, there it is. You know, now we can see the depth of it and what drives all this. What is the inner logic of all this craziness? There it is.
Right. That's fortunate for you, and I kind of came to the same place. It seems to me, though, that most people that come to this place, you know, whether it be friends, family, listeners, followers of Guy's work or my work, is that they come to a great place of grief. And I read your article, In the Age of Grief, and you talk a lot about denial of loss and the refusal to mourn. And it seems to me that many of our listeners they struggle because they really can't mourn publicly.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about grief and maybe...
Well, that's very well put, Mike. I think that's it. I mean, that's what denial is about, too. You can't... You have to just kind of... I'm fine. You know, how are you today? I'm fine. And everybody goes on. We go through our routines, and we don't... you know, we don't make a stink in the room over what we're really thinking about or feeling.
Right.
And it's all tied together, because here we are. We're all trapped in it. Nobody has a privileged position. I mean, relatively speaking, you know, I'm as caught in it as anybody else, you know, but so, you know, it really is a mammoth task. But I think it's, you know, when the system really doesn't have any answers anymore, and where does it have any answers anymore, then it doesn't look good for what is, you know, managing this and keeping this around. I mean, it may be on its last legs. Maybe it sounds crazy to say that, but, you know, it's just so ruinous that people, how can you avoid the question that it's just screwing up everything? It's not, and only technology now comes around to give the answers, right? Makes the claims, makes the promises, because political ideology, I think, is just dead in the water. Nobody believes it anymore. So you just have the techno companies and the ads and the whole ideology there. Okay, yeah, things are screwed up, but we're working on it. It'll be okay. We're going to fix it. You know, let's build a smarter planet, the IBM mantra. Well, you have to see that it has caused the very problems that then it comes around to say we'll solve. You know, so
yeah.
That doesn't work. It just doesn't work. You can see that it's not working. Every day the industrial disasters mount, you know, the craziness of it mounts, right? So what are you missing here, you know?
You bring up a good point, that of being trapped, you know, that we're all trapped in this set of living arrangements. I suspect you're frequently asked about your own lifestyle and how it fits with your writing and your speaking. So, of course, we'll ask again. How do you pursue a different way of living beyond the mainstream?
Except, again, I was a child of the 60s, so when I made the decision to just pursue what I wanted to do and not have any regard for money, I guess I was part hippie already or something. You know, in other words, for years, I survived on selling my plasma, and I didn't expect to make any money, but I had my time. If you choose between time and money, but of course now it's much harder to do that. I mean, for example, I borrowed a lot of money when I was in grad school, working on my own stuff in grad school, and then I declared bankruptcy on all of it. I didn't have any respect for the institution, and when I left, I just flagged it off. I went into court, and the judge was sort of furious with me. I just waited. I knew he had to sign the paper. I walked out without any debt.
Right.
You know,
You're not playing the game, John.
Well, you know, you can't do that anymore. Kids can't do that. I mean, it's no free bankruptcy ticket for them, you know.
Right.
So, again, you had to spill over from the 60s, and, yeah, I just kind of smirked and walked out. Fuck you. I'm not going to be in debt to your shit.
Right.
I've got better things to do.
Yeah, I think the alternative today is default. You see people defaulting on their school loans all the time. I think we saw a number the other day. It's up to 7 million students that are not paying their student loans back.
Ah, right, right.
Yeah. At least.
Good. Well, I've never had credit in my life. I've never had a credit card. I've never planned on buying a house or anything. So, you know, credit means nothing to me. But if you want to have credit, I mean, I don't even know how you swing these things because I've never been interested. But,
yeah,
default. Yeah, the hell with it. Why should
you
be enslaved to crap you don't even believe in? You know, except it's not that easy. You can say that, but then, you know, how do you live? I mean, you know, I'm aware of that.
Yeah, and
we have grandkids right here, and they're, you know, they're struggling. They, you know, they, how did they get by? I mean, I chose a different route to not even go that way at all. So, and that's fine. It was fine for me, but I'm not putting down people who are stuck with, you know, the practical stuff.
Right. And, you know, and I think that's what I point to. You know, I point to people like yourself. When somebody asks me, you know, what else can we do? There are other options. I mean, you don't have to pay that bill, and there are consequences, clearly. But if there are certain things you want, like a credit score, like you mentioned, in a house and things like that, then, you know, of course you're going to pursue that particular route. But I get the impression that most people think there's no other way to do these things. And I'm doing it differently. Guy's doing it differently. You're doing it differently. So there is a way to function in this mess with keeping a little bit of sanity left.
Yeah, I think you're right, man. It's not just totally either or. You know, you don't have to live on the streets to, you know, do what you want. I mean, but it's not easy. But, yeah, there are ways. People carve out ways to get by and do what they really need to do.
Right, and I think that's what happens is, clearly, this culture has confused its wants and its needs. Its wants have become the needs, and I see that it seems to be the path, at least.
Yeah, when the alternatives are ruled out, choice means, you know, brand A or brand B or brand C, you know, right? So that's what you're served up. So, and yet, as you imply, there are a lot of people that are not happy with that.
Yeah.
That don't get off on owning a lot of stuff. I mean, you find that all over the place. It's and there are different aspects of that too, especially in Europe, like in Italy and France. I know there are different, you know, slow food, slow roads, slow, you know, the voluntary simplicity stuff. I don't know how far that goes, but you know, there are aspects that people are not just buying into everything and in the rat race they're trying to resist it.
So I want to change focus just a little bit here and go back to your roots. You mentioned the 60s several times. Do you have mentors today, met or unmet? Do you have people out there who are providing a beacon for you and your efforts? Do you read? Do you listen? What are the influences on you today that continue beyond the period of your trial by fire in the 1960s, the American Cultural Revolution?
Well, I think the people that are in the forest resistance, forest defense, that's gotten harder to do as well. But there are people there on the front lines, of course, in terms of the fracking and the pipelines and trying to defeat the timber sales, you know, to stop out here in the West, you know, to keep them from logging off everything, you know, from clear cutting everything. That's very strong here in Oregon. It has been, and that's really, to me, inspiring. I have friends in prison that, you know, have had the courage to do stuff. I work with a group of people like Kevin Tucker, and I won't list a bunch of names, but Black and Green Review, Green and Black Review, that's a new publication that's really inspiring. They've done amazing stuff, and now I'm becoming an editor there to just be part of what they're doing. There are different projects, you know, and people pursue it. People try to, and people even try to, you know, stay outside of the internet, stay offline. That's an uphill thing. You know, we're forced to do stuff that we wouldn't ordinarily do. You know, there's not much choice in that. I'd like to keep writing letters, but who responds to your letters, you know, whenever it's just emails. But yeah, I think there are sources of inspiration, and getting back to, again, the reference to Native people that are really up against it in various places. I think of Otum folks, some of whom I've had the honor to get to know on the Arizona-Mexico border, a hugely militarized place. The Otum reservation is now carved into two, and they need a passport to travel on their own land. You know, and it's Border Patrol, just crazy, and the cartel in the South, and hanging on to the traditions, their elders teaching the way to respect the land. These are the things that there's no substitute for, and you know, that's the connection that's still there. Too many people don't think there are any Native folks left, I suppose, but that's not so.
Right, you mentioned writing letters, and I still get letters from a few people. There's one guy who writes me, and he purposely writes handwritten letters, and he's written 12,000 over the last few years. And then, of course, you mostly get handwritten letters from people who are incarcerated, not from who don't believe they're incarcerated. You know, we're all in this jail known as civilization. But we send email messages on the outside, and the people with the bars that are widely recognized send handwritten letters. So I get handwritten letters from friends who are incarcerated. Can you talk about that, the concept of the incarceration that goes beyond domestication? Yes, we're domesticated, but what does that mean? And you've mentioned a couple of examples already of how constrained we are in our ability to interact with each other.
Well, it's just, you know, I think I mentioned this community, I think, is a real touchstone. And that's a word that's used by developers and politicians. I suppose they still use that word a lot, but it really has been made to disappear. And that's the real tragedy. It's gone. And again, that's why I think the deepest reason, the somewhat obvious reason for these shootings, these unexplained, you know, eruptions that now are just so chronic, that's when you don't have community. You don't have ties. You don't have solidarity, you know, like we once used to have. And then that's what we're talking about. I think the primitivist thing is how do we establish community when we know that mass society doesn't provide it? It doesn't allow us to be accountable and responsible. You have to just pick up the phone and call somebody for anything now. You know, we've lost all these skills, things that are now, you know, billions and billions spent on what we knew for millennia, you know, outside of civilization. You need a book on anything. You know, did people have this giant library of how-to books to have kids, to raise their kids?
Right.
You know, I mean, it's just, it's kind of crazy when you think of the de-skilling that civilization effects. It's scary. We don't know how to do anything. And I'm not privileging myself. I don't know how to do much, that's for sure. So we've got to reskill. We got to go against this tie. tied, and that includes the ties that have been sundered, and you know, we're adrift. We're all trying to go against the tide, and there's every kind of examples, you know, reading groups and you name it. There are efforts all the time to have something, you know, to have some type of community, the anarchist community or whatever it is, you know, but yet, you know, Robert Putnam, in his famous Bowling Alone book of, what, almost 20 years ago now, that kind of stuff has just faded away. And what you get is kind of obvious. It's just, it's really deeply sad. There's where the grief comes in again. People live lives that they don't even have, they don't have a connection anymore. So what's the point? You know, it's hard to imagine, I think, for most of us, still most of us, to imagine somebody getting a weapon and just going to some place and just killing people. I mean, that didn't used to happen. Right. Now we know it's happening, and it's just too awful to, it isn't allowed to talk about that. It just isn't allowed. You can talk about, and the liberals talk about bullshit stuff about gun control. There were guns in every household from colonial times, but people weren't doing this, were they, until about 20 years ago? They weren't. You know, and I mean, talk about nonsense stuff. Oh, mental health. Very few of these people are mentally nuts. I mean, they're just not. More often, the cliche is, guy never missed work, never turned his stereo loud, he was always pleasant, perfect family, you know, blah, right. blah, blah. That's way more the stereotype, right? And not just a stereotype. And then he blew.
Yeah.
You know, he just knew it was all gone. And, you know, it's there right in front of our eyes, but nobody talks about it. The progressives sure as hell don't talk about it, right?
Well, I think that people are so... hierarchy is all they know and all we know, and they cannot seem to make a connection or the leap between something like primitivism and anarchy and how those things are actually community and community building. They can't see beyond the hierarchy, is my experience at least. Somebody being in charge.
Well, they don't, but in a vacuum, I mean, you know, it isn't a free choice, like, oh, I can imagine this or I can imagine that. Of course, it's steadily reproduced and reinforced by media of all kinds on all sides, and we know what is forbidden. You know, what is not going to be talked about.
Right.
I mean, it's just, that's just the way it is. I mean, maybe that'll be changing as more pressure to kick the door open, or maybe not. I mean, maybe never, but
yeah.
I think it will change. It's only, you know, when you mentioned people go around and they're somewhat mute about the grief, well, yeah, because it isn't really allowed to express that. And I mean, you know, to shift it over what we were just talking about, it's really not allowed, you know, straight up,
right.
not
yeah.
allowed. I mean, it's not that you go to prison, but you don't get the invitation. And I've had some invitations that were withdrawn, and I'm not a conspiracy person, but I just felt like, well, for The Daily Show, for example, I was going to debate Ray Kurzweil about technology. That went away after it was all set up. It could be he finked out, but, you know, they're just not going to, that's not going to be on offer. They don't want that. They don't want to hear about that. And with some exceptions, you know, but, and, you know, so how do people imagine something if they never hear about it? And what it takes to hear about it, getting back to something I said at the top of the hour here, well, they heard about Seattle. 60 Minutes came here to talk to us about why people would fuck up downtown Seattle. And we had some answers. Not that we were confessing to anything, but,
yeah.
You know, when people say, you know, set fire to McDonald's in Mexico City, and then they accompany that with a communique about how they're strangling in this awful madness of mass society, well, then if there's an access to media, and that's what forces the issue sometimes, you've got to publish. And of course, the Unabomber did that pretty well. He forced them to publish his so-called manifesto. because of what he did. You want some more of that, or should, or do you want to publish this? Of course, then they busted him before we found out if he was ever going to do any more. But, you know, I'm afraid that's what it takes. And if we don't have what it takes to do the resistance, to maybe freak people out, oh, these anarchists are horrible. Okay, we're horrible. And think about it. How's your life going? How horrible is it? You're going to just sit there passively and then die without even living? Maybe we have to pass through that stage of making people a little uncomfortable before we get through that and start making some real headway.
Well, I don't think anything of significance can be learned without discomfort. You know, you can learn the times tables, and that's pretty comfortable, but
right,
if it's not
right.
making you uncomfortable, I don't think it's important that you learn it personally. So you mentioned community, and I absolutely agree that community is everything and that the dominant culture has largely stripped it away, including the mainstream media, of course. So do you have a tribe? Who do you collaborate with? Who do you work with locally?
Well, I have to some degree, and I'm not saying this is a hunter-gatherer band society, obviously, but I was in a housing co-op here in Eugene, Oregon for 15 years from the late 80s to the early 2000s, and it was wonderful. It was fabulous. I was living across the street in a household of people, and then that, and then I learned about the co-op and applied, and anyway, it was, you know, a lovely place, you know, self-managed. We certainly were connected with the bigger society, no doubt about that. We had trouble paying off the mortgages and so forth, but that was great. We decided things in a face-to-face way, and wonderful learning experience for me. I learned, for one thing, how women operate when you've got a fairly large percentage of women there as part of the body, the decision-making body. That's something I maybe thought about slightly, maybe in a formal sense, but I actually learned about that, how it works, and that was pretty cool. So, you know, but again, if you go back to the 60s, it was all, I mean, there were so many people living together, and then you don't have to sweat the rent so much, you know, the whole thing. And now it's harder to do that, but it's still possible.
Right.
And yeah, that kind of rescued me. I had more slack to do my own work. You know, if I wanted to spend every day of the week in the library trying to, you know, read and suss things out, well, that's what I did. I didn't have to spend much time worrying about the rent.
Right on. But talk a little bit about you've had our radio show for 15 years. That's a community, I would assume. I wonder if you could talk about your show.
Oh, yeah, that's great. Well, it's a great gang there. It's University of Oregon. It's college radio. Before that, we had pirate radio here. We had Radio Free Cascadia, but that was busted down by the feds and local cops with their guns drawn. Anyway, so I went across town to the campus, and luckily, they had a slot, and so I moved in there. Yeah, I've been there ever since. It's been fine.
Great show. I mean, you've been on 15 years, correct?
Yeah.
And so
I love it.
Give us an idea of what you want to accomplish or the purpose of your show, really.
Well, it's an anarchist talk show, and there are a few around the country. There's The Final Straw in North Carolina. Well, I could reel off a few that are wonderful shows, I won't get into a list, I guess, but yeah, that's pretty cool. That's a little bit of a network, and it's kind of informal. We have kind of talked about hooking up more, but you know, there are connections, and you know, there's different kinds of radio, different rules, the FCC, you know, if it's community radio, college radio, etc. But that's not, people can do that. I mean, I would urge people to think about that. If they have access, people, these stations, they need people. And you could just go ahead and do a music show with talking or whatever you want to do. It's probably, I don't know how hard it is. Of course, in some places it would be impossible if you live out somewhere, I suppose. But, you know, then you can, and I got to tell you, for me, it's just a giant mental health thing. because there I am spouting off. And if I didn't have, what I mean? I'm sure you know. You do the same stuff, man. I would probably blow my lid if I didn't get to get on the microphone and just let it fly.
Well, that's
I got
what
a guy on tonight
you.
From Free Radical Radio down in Oakland who's passing through. We're going to do the show together tonight at 7 Pacific time, and that'll be fun. I'm going to grill him on what's going on down there.
Right.
He's just en route from the Seattle Anarchist Book Fair, by the way, this past weekend. Mm-hmm. So we get to find out what went down up there.
Well, it's good to know that it's also a coping mechanism for you as well.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, none of us have a lot of people we can talk to about these issues because radicalism has been so disparaged by this culture that when you even call yourself a radical, you're interested in going deep on an issue, people think that you're an extremist. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, having these radical conversations is a gift that we can share with a relatively small number of people. I'm sure there are people out there right now who are calling the black helicopters on us involved in this conversation.
No doubt.
So yeah, you have a book coming out, and it has the word.
Oh,
hope.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks for asking. It's getting close. I think the at Feral House it said December 1, but I think it's only about a week from being available. Why hope? Oh. It's just another collection of stuff, including the eponymous piece. Why hope is just a small thing at the end, but I wanted to kind of feature it because there is a lot of defeatism, you know, and there's a lot of nihilism, cynicism, because this is a postmodern culture, and that's what that's about. You know, that's just the layer that hangs over things. You're not supposed to stand for anything. You know, the idea that everybody, any story is equal to any other story, and it's all just stories, and all that just kind of, I find it kind of debilitating. Yeah, we should listen to everybody. Of course we should, but that doesn't mean every point of view is equal to any other point of view. That's sad when we get to that place, and it's just, yeah, whatever. You know, it cheapens the dialogue, and it doesn't further dialogue. So I wanted to kind of take aim at that. Because among anarchists, too, you find a bunch of this, too. There's no privileged position, and it's kind of an infection among various anarchists, too. Fortunately, not so many. I think the younger kids, there's a very vibrant thing out there, and I think there's a lot of energy. We're not seeing as many signs of it at this moment, but the energy is still there. And that I always come back to the difference between, and at my age I do remember this, the collapse of the movement of the 60s. It was just over. There was no doubt about it. Now, I think things are at somewhat of a low ebb, but it's not the same. The energy is still there. I really think that it's waiting, you know, to erupt again.
Well, that's good news.
Yeah. Do you think that's true?
Let's finish on that bit of good news. Thank you, John Zerzan, for joining us today on the Progressive Radio Network.
We really appreciate
your
work, and we're looking forward to the book.
Thanks very much.
All right, John. All right. The old climate update summary.
Yes. Before I do that, if you read my brief essay on the blog today, you know that I'll be writing infrequently in the future. I'm still available for speaking tours and workshops, but I'll be writing a lot less. I'll still update my long climate change essay, however, and I encourage you to check in with it now and then. It'll be updated every few days, as it has been in the past.
It seems that, and I had the same question as well, and some people have asked it online. When I first read it, you mentioned you lost some critical support, and maybe you can expand on that.
Yeah, I mean, there are people in the all-volunteer group that are, that they have their own lives, you know, and it's time to move on and not spend so much time helping me get the message out. You know, Aesop said 2,600 years ago, after all is said and done, more is said than done. And there's really little left for me to say beyond near-term human extinction.
Right.
So maybe it's time I said a lot less. And the people who are volunteering their time to work with me, I really appreciate what they've done. But it can be an enormous task.
Sure. Especially when you got your site hacked all the time.
Right. And they've had issues as well.
Right, yeah. There's no, you're not protected just because you're a helper.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a bad deal, but I understand perfectly that people have things to do.
Absolutely. And, you know, maybe this gives an opportunity for some other people that are looking to get involved as well. So if you're out there, think about it.
Well, and in fact, Lily from Phoenix has stepped up just within the last few days and will be tracking down, doing research, and sending us information about the Doomer of the Week. So
excellent.
Thanks to Lily, the flower in the desert.
Absolutely. Thank you.
I mentioned to her that we can call her flower if we want to. It's straight out of that movie.
Right.
Which one? Bambi.
Bambi.
Bambi, right.
Right.
Yeah, about the skunk. Speaking of skunks, from the August 21st, 2015 issue of Science comes a review paper on boreal forests and their response to climate change. As you can imagine, the response isn't so great. The result, the study concludes, is that the forest is likely to transform from an unbroken canopy of green to a mixed landscape with groves of trees separated by open grasslands. The lead author on the paper, a guy named Shepashinko, I'm pretty sure I got that exactly right, says during an interview, quote, "This forest will convert to a type of savanna. The consequences of the shift will be sweeping and affect everything from the billions of songbirds that nest in the forest to industries," of course that was the primary motivation
right.
behind the article, "to industries that depend on its vast reserves to stored carbon now locked in permafrost beneath it." In other words, we have yet another example of feedbacks interacting in a manner that accelerates both feedbacks. We have the permafrost under the boreal forest is going to be exposed as the trees die in the forest. That's going to accelerate the death of the trees, which is going to accelerate the release of methane from the permafrost.
But to be clear, it's not going to impact us.
No, of course. It all happens January 1st, 2100.
Good, because I got shit to do.
Yeah, I know. I've added a link to this paper under feedback number 22, which focuses on tree mortality as a result of climate change.
Great.
July 2015, as most of us have heard by now, was the hottest month ever recorded by humans on Earth. Without a major change in planetary temperature, we're headed for the hottest year in history. It seems that the record hot year of 2015 will eclipse the previous record, which we might remember was last year.
Right. Well, and we've experienced it in Phoenix and Tucson, so.
Yes. We're having big fun now.
Yes, we are.
There's nothing like going out into a car that's been sitting in a parking lot for an hour in the wide open sunshine and closing all the doors and just sitting there and soaking it up for a while.
Right.
Because the place you just came from has a thermostat set at 64 degrees.
Yeah.
Fahrenheit.
I like that.
Oh, it's lovely. Today's other news related to climate change is all about fires. From Washington State's largest fire in history to eastern Siberia, the world is on fire. Typical headline graced yesterday's issue of The Guardian, quote, "When firefighters speak out on global warming, we ought to listen. 30-year, 40-year veterans have never seen this before."
Good times. So what haven't they seen necessarily?
They haven't seen fires of this scale.
Okay, so scale.
Yeah, I mean, they're just huge. You know, eastern Siberia, the smoke is blanketing a huge area.
Yeah.
A friend, Paul Marcotte, who we've interviewed on this show, sent a little video clip yesterday from Bend, Oregon, and he just did a 360, and it was all smoke.
And, of course, you can see all this on CNN, Fox, and MSNBC.
Every day, of course, they're talking
it's
about
usually
climate
leading story,
change.
Right.
Oh, wait. That's not right.
So Lily found us a Doomer of the Week.
The Doomer of the Week this week is Daryl B. West, who wrote the following poem in the Near Term Extinction Love Group on Facebook. It's titled, "The Tears Still Flow." "They say the sea level's rising and threatens to swamp the land, but my tears still flow unfettered because I have lost your hand. Yes, my tears still flow in anguish for the world I have lost in you, and a heart that is so broken for the love I felt so true. The tears still flow by gallons, an ocean they would fill, as briny as the sea itself, your absence, a bitter pill. So the sea level's rising inexorably and every day, but my tears still flow in rivers forever, or so they say." So thanks again to Lily from Phoenix for researching and forwarding that tidbit. Lily, the flower in the desert, will be providing this service for future shows as well, with our thanks.
And well said, Daryl.
Indeed.
Okay, folks, that about wraps it up this week. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last, and the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions. We have decided that we will be doing a monthly call-in show because that seemed to be a pretty big hit, talking to the good doctor. So we'll do that, and we'll announce when that's going to be for the month of September. Please continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. And we'll see you next week on the radio. Make sure to find us on iTunes and the archives at PRN.FM. And thanks again to John Zerzan for his work and wisdom this week, and Apperson for his music. Next week, we will speak with grief walker Stephen Jenkinson. But until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.
She's coming out swinging. She bats last and she's just a